Let there be all victory for the chanting of the holy name of Lord Krishna, which can cleanse the mirror of the heart and stop the miseries of the blazing fire of material existence. That chanting is the waxing moon that spreads the white lotus of good fortune for all living entities. It is the life and soul of all education. The chanting of the holy name of Krishna expands the blissful ocean of transcendental life. It gives a cooling effect to everyone and enables one to taste full nectar at every step. Om Agana Timanandasya Agananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Dhanitam Yenam Tasamai Shri Dhirve Namah
Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Guru Vandana Shri Chaitanya Shivasi Gaura Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare.
First, we want to establish how chanting Hare Krishna is the pinnacle of spiritual practice and the conclusion of the Vedas. First, we need to understand, of course, that Bhakti Marg, the path of loving devotion to Krishna, is the highest perfection of life. Now, this is difficult to understand in sociological context, in the context of society, because we don't have a real human civilization today. I'm sorry to inform. We often comment at initiation how the four regular principles are not meant to make you a transcendentalist in of themselves. The four regular principles, those four rules, are to make you a human being. So, in a real human society, these things don't have to be mentioned. Krishna doesn't mention them in Bhagavad Gita explicitly, because it's assumed he's talking to Arjuna, who's a caliber far beyond human beings today. That is the advantage of hearing Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. You are hearing from persons who are far beyond the caliber of persons today. And so therefore, by reading Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam authentically, you tap into that wisdom culture and treasure house of knowledge and experience that's far beyond what is available to the greatest material intellects of this day and age. So this is why Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam sometimes can appear to be a bit far beyond us. Because in one sense, they are. And that's good. It takes a while for us to humbly accept our situation in a very unadvanced world, which is very expert at passionately making progress to destroy itself. It takes a while for us to humbly accept that, because after all, we look at the little gadgets and trinkets that surround us, and we look at our home entertainment system or the entertainment that's available in our city, and we think, nothing could be better than this. Sometimes speak about living in Manhattan, in New York City. What could be better than this? Manhattan, the center of the universe. Everything, just within a short subway ride. The greatest events, the greatest happenings, all just 10 minutes away from my door. This is the pinnacle of life. I thought that way, of course, and until I heard Srila Prabhupada speak so critically of New York City. Oh, it's a dirty place. It's a noisy place. So as many of you know, that was my only challenge in taking up the process of bhakti, having to get over Srila Prabhupada's criticism of New York. I thought it was, you know, like Dwarka Puri or something. So, I'm saying that so that we can see, by example, how attached we are to a very problematic and ignorant society. The problems and ignorance go so deep that we actually take it as normal. But if you look at the standard of Bhagavad Gita, when Krishna starts to speak to Arjuna, you see it's just far above anything that, in terms of social problems, that we cope with today. You look at Arjuna's reasons for not fighting, and they were of such a noble integrity, far beyond what persons would value today. And yet still, Krishna told him, "You're speaking big words, but you're a fool." So, with that chastisement by Krishna, and Arjuna's accepting, Bhagavad Gita takes off. So how to bring people up to that standard today in which they can actually get on the airplane, let's speak of taking off. This is a problem in a society that is highly problematic, in that the society discourages spiritual advancement, directly and indirectly. So much agitation is going on all around you, 24/7, and you learn to take that as normal. It's like when you've been in the center of the city all the time, then you come out to a place like this, and you realize, I don't hear any traffic. I don't hear any hustle and bustle and other people's music playing. I don't hear anything. So we don't understand, we don't realize how affected we are by passion and ignorance. That is taken for granted in today's culture. Oh, fact. It's encouraged that your lusts go uncontrolled. Get all the things you can get. Yet we see that people are totally unsatisfied, and they're becoming more and more psychologically unstable as the decades go by. This is brought out by statistics that the rate of depression, the rate of mental problems, has in some cases increased tenfold. So where is that great progress? Where is the advancement? I remember talking to a dentist, and I was asking him, so what did people do in the 19th century when there weren't any dentists? He said, well, first of all, they didn't eat all the junk food that everyone eats now, so there was not much need for dentists. No need for dentists. And what did people do in the 19th century without any psychologists and psychiatrists? We seldom think that a lot of these occupations have developed recently, in recent human history, in response to the self-afflicted problems of human society. Oh, then you may look at the duration of life. Ah, the duration of life has increased. Maybe, but what's the use in a long life, which is simply problematic and causing others problems and causing nature problems? What's the use of a few more years? That's all. 10 more years than previously, on average. If those 10 more years are used to destroy oneself and nature, what's the point? Nature will get rid of you. The Bhagavatam points out that nature gets rid of human beings when they're off track in three ways. Famine, not enough food, not enough water, pestilence, attacks of predator insects and things like that, as well as war. It seems that war is the method of choice these days, but also there is a world food problem, which is increasing. So, when we consider our situation in terms of society and individuals in society, if we can understand truly what's going on, we realize that our situation is desperate. And even if you think that human society is living longer than ever before, according to known human history, which isn't very much. The statistics for the duration of human life do not include abortions. So add in the abortions and watch that statistic for duration of life drop dramatically. Add in all the abortions in the world. Well, but they're not human beings yet, so they don't count. But as soon as they pop out of the womb, or after how many months, they're a human being. Some arbitrary legal limit, or when the embryo crosses that line, suddenly you can't kill the baby. Before, it's up to you. In this way, we can see that these statistics are not telling the full picture. And because people are so insensitive as a whole, and they don't know. Yes, innocent, because they don't know. Nevertheless, material nature holds you responsible for whether you know or not. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. So, it is true. Born into ignorance, don't know any better, and then the ignorance is perpetuated generation after generation. I was looking to see what the weather was, and got the Met site online, and they had advertisements also. So there was one, it's an advertisement for find out what New Zealand dairy wives think, wives of dairy farmers. Find out what they think. I thought, this is interesting. It was like an advertisement for the, the Women's Dairy Network. All the wives of dairy farmers, they have their own network to inspire one another. So I thought, well, wait a minute. Women generally love their children, and when they get into the maternal process, they get all their emotions focused in that way. So how is it that these ladies can deny that in terms of dealing with calves? Because the New Zealand tradition, I learned, is that the husband, he takes care of the main dairy operations, and the wife traditionally takes care of the calves. And so the theme of the discussion was how to keep your husband, how to keep your partner out of the calving room. Because it's considered the woman's domain, traditionally. That the woman, she is responsible for the calves because they're smaller, and it's not as a physically intense operation as taking care of the cows and bulls. Bulls, are they allowed to survive? To whatever extent bulls are allowed to live, because they don't give milk, therefore they're off to the slaughterhouses. And the calves, as you know, so many of those little calves, they go for veal because human beings, they like that supposedly succulent taste of little calf's flesh. But meanwhile, you have the ladies in the dairy network all talking about their experiences in running the calving operation. We keep the men out of there, you know, we don't want, it's like our kitchen. We want to run it ourselves, we'll take care of the little calves. But don't these ladies know what they're doing? Don't they think they're raising the calves for slaughter? Where is their motherly instinct? You know, ladies are very attracted, most of them to little babies. Oh, how cute. That little calf is so cute and helpless. But still, they are blinded. They can't see. This is the power of Maya. We're giving this as an example about the power of the illusory energy to cover you, and the ignorance is perpetuated. How is my situation going to be remedied? First, let's understand what a real human civilization consists of. In a real human civilization, you will find various paths openly available. Number one, karmakanda, the path of karmic activity performed scientifically for getting the maximum material reactions, results, including not simply in this life, but in your next life, getting a better material situation. It's like doing what you have to do to immigrate to a better country. Or a country that thinks it's better. Like those of you who have gone through the immigration process to enter the heavenly planets of New Zealand. You know what it's like. You have to be vetted, you have to submit a police report, you have to give a medical report. Are you qualified to enter into the heavenly planets? Is your karma good enough? And of course, the easiest way is to have heaps of money. We're going to invest this money in New Zealand. Come right in, come right in. No problem. Or if you are very skillful to manipulate the system, like our Nitya Priya did, they'll even pre-invite you based on some perceived occupational need. Or if you're a doctor, like Chi, no problem. So, in the same way that you qualify yourself to go to another country, just like if you want to go to the USA, you get 3 months as a New Zealander automatically. But even that could be at the discretion of the immigration officer when you land in Los Angeles. He can just not like the look of you. One did that to Shastra Krit. 2 months, that's all you get. And if you try to apply to extend your visa, you have to convince them that you're not, you know, in the USA looking for a job. And if you try to get a visa, a regular visa, before you leave New Zealand, they want to know, where do you work? Do you own a house? Show us some guarantee that you'll be coming back. Yeah. So the same thing about other planets. In a real human society, it's understood that you perform karma to go to that better destination. So you see, it's not such a strange idea at all. Of course, I know life on other planets. Those of you who have any doubts, we'll talk about it after Sunday night. When we show our documentary. So, that's one path available. Karmakanda. That's the minimum in a real human society. below the path of karmakanda, balancing the punya with the papa, balancing pious activities to counteract impious activities. It's like investment banking. You got a loss in this sector, you counter it with a gain in that sector. So that's karmakanda. Okay, I did something wrong in this arena of my life. I'll dig some wells and plant some fruit trees, and that'll counteract them. You're always making it. And of course, life is so intricate, you really don't know whether things are balancing out. Like you read in the Krishna book about Maharaj Niga, who, he was just renowned for giving charity so expansively. He would give to the brahmanas. That's another aspect of the real human society. Those with wealth, those with power, see themselves as subordinate to the brahmanas, because the brahmanas have the greatest wealth of knowledge and sense control. So Niga, he would give so liberally on a scale we can't imagine to brahmanas. Cows and gold and precious items. Of course, brahmanas will only accept what they need because they're living very simply. That's another aspect of a real human society. Yes, everyone gives to the brahmanas, but the brahmanas give practically all away. So that's a very purified way of economic reciprocation. So anyway, in spite of all the charity Niga had done, he made a mistake. He was giving away thousands upon thousands of cows to brahmanas, and he slipped up once. He, in a huge herd of cows that he gave to one brahmana, somehow there was a cow that he had already given to another brahmana. And so, these particular brahmanas, well, evidently, they were not so spiritually advanced. You see, brahmana is mode of goodness. A brahmana Vaishnava, a brahmana who's dedicated to Krishna's service, that's a notch above, that's a position above the three modes of material nature. But these brahmanas, evidently, they were a little, when someone's easily destabilized or agitated, what do you say?
Put out.
Edgy. Volatile. Yeah, well, I guess they were volatile and edgy and just hot-tempered, I guess. Maybe they thought too much of their brahmana status. So, a whole altercation started. This is my cow. No, he already gave that cow to me. And then the problem turned upon Niga. You have done a great wrong. You have given a brahmana's property away. So, what was Niga's response? Look, no problem. I can solve the crisis caused by that one cow. I'll give you tens of thousands of cows. What's the problem? And that brahmana said, no, no, no. It's this one cow. So, evidently, Niga was destined for a reduction in his opulence in his future birth. So, he was cursed. Cursed to become what? Yes, very lowly creature. Just because of this offense, this slip-up in his karmic activities. He was not doing devotional activities. He was doing good karma, giving cows to brahmanas. This was not devotional service. As I said, these brahmanas were ritualistic, and they were the priests involved in advising your karmic activity so you get the best result. So anyway, he got a lousy result. He became a lizard. So the point is, that's it. This karma, good karma effort, that is That's materialism in a sane society. Now, beneath that, everything is considered animalistic. In this way, we are trying to show you that today's society doesn't classify as human. The Vedas will inform you that human society at least begins with karmakanda, performing pious activities, knowing what is sinful activity, because you know that what goes around comes around. So therefore, you're always negotiating, you're always maneuvering so that too much bad karma doesn't overtake your good karma. You're always concerned with that. And it's very intricate, as Yuga found out. Just one slip up and you can just be caught in an avalanche of bad karma, just for one slip up. That's how this universe is. It's actually a minefield. But we don't see it because we're so focused on our sensory inputs. And also, we have no knowledge. So we just think, here we are in the world, and we just do what we like. We fulfill ourselves. We follow our dream. Little sense activity here, a little sense activity there. We're like little children wandering around in the middle of a motorway. Just like sometimes you see the little children here. They don't understand this program, what's going on. They just in another universe, in another dimension. They're in their own little kiddie world. And you notice, they really seek out another kid, You can understand. These adults, they're out of it. They just don't relate. So then you find another little child, they embrace, let's play. We have so many important things to do. These strangers in the room, these big people, who knows what they're doing and why. So we're like that, those little kids in this world. I'll make some money. I'll watch television. I'll eat this. I'll go to this cafe. I'll increase my family. We have no idea of the system we're embedded in. So a real human society understands that perfectly. But that's materialism, according to the Vedic point of view. Anything beneath that is considered animal life. Then you go a bit above that, and you have other options. Gyanakanda. To understand that you are not matter, but you are spirit, and that there is an all-pervading spiritual energy. That is the beginning of transcendental life, life beyond material nature. And also, you can become a mystic yogi and practice all kinds of yoga techniques for increasing your mystic powers, far beyond what human beings are aware of today. Today, mystic power is considered, bending a spoon with your mind, or reading someone's mind or seeing their aura. Remembering a few glimpses of your past life. Wow. But this is not mystic power, according to the Vedas. The Vedic mystic powers are so much more, so much more powerful. So much of what you read in the Vedas is about mystic powers, which are considered to be simply a subtle form of materialism. The mystic yogi thinks, why should I worry about balancing the good karma and the bad karma? And it's so intricate. I'll just go to the top of a mountain in the Himalayas and dedicate my life to attaining mystic powers, and I can even violate the laws of nature. I can get whatever I want. I can fly, I can dip in a river and come out in a different place, far away. I can reach my hand and grab whatever I want. I can even enter into someone's body and use their body to experience what I want to experience. So that choice is there in a real human society. Bhakti is the pinnacle because it is dealing right with the conclusion of the Vedas. Bhakti actually is beyond understanding that you are a spirit soul. Bhakti is all about you're a spirit soul in relation to what? Once you understand that you're existing as a spiritual entity in relation with a supreme spiritual entity, then you've got to start thinking about what are the obligations, and in fact, what are the joys of that relationship. It's like waking up one morning and suddenly realizing, I'm married. I don't know what it's like, but maybe some of you had that experience, you know? The full impact hits you after the yajna. You felt the change around you? I mean, you felt the joy around you? Suddenly, you realize, wait a minute, life's not the same. I have obligations. I have commitment. So that's the difference between simply understanding that you are spirit soul, a spiritual entity, and understanding that there is a supreme spiritual entity, and you have a relationship, you have a commitment, you have duties. And in fact, you have an opportunity for the greatest love. So that is the conclusion of the Vedas, bhakti. Yes, if you're very, very intelligent, just by material intelligence, not the type known today, you can figure out that you're not the body and that there's an all-pervading spiritual reality. You can do that with your material intelligence. But that's as far as you get. That's as far as you can get using your material intelligence. You cannot understand that way the super soul in everyone's heart. You cannot understand the supreme enjoyer, Bhagavan, Krishna, the Adi Purusha, the original person. You can't understand that with material intelligence. So bhakti is dealing with the last stage of human development, in which you go beyond even accepting that there's a creator, a maintainer, and a destroyer. You actually understand that there is only one enjoyer, and guess what? It's not you. That is the intimidating thing about bhakti. In case you're wondering why sometimes you feel a little put out, you feel a little, things are a little tight around your collar, you feel a little inhibited in what human society today considers prime necessities, it's because, yes, bhakti recognizes there's one enjoyer, and it's not you. One purusha, one enjoyer, all of the living entities are prakriti. They are meant to be enjoyed by that enjoyer. This is a radical change in consciousness. And obviously, except in rare circumstances, that radical change is not going to happen overnight. We need a means to gradually take us from one shore to the other. So that we can experience our true identity. In a real way, not a theoretical way, not a religious beliefy way. I believe that I am pure spirit soul. And I believe that I am part of Krishna. Well, that's nice, but as we pointed out in our little book, Bhakti Bhava, you're not going to get very far with just theory and belief. You need a dynamic process that's going to trigger the reawakening of your real identity. The material world is a dynamic process, in case you haven't noticed. Things are working on you in material life. Your own body and mind are working you over. Material nature is working you over. It's not simply you get worked over at your workplace or at the university. These are all processes. The workplace, the university, home, entertainment. These are all processes that you get caught up in, absorbed in, and things happen to you. So how are you going to get out of the dynamics of material nature? Simply with religious belief and theory. It's not going to happen. So that's why, especially here in New Zealand, you'll see people are very cynical about quote-unquote religion. They don't see, for the most part, that it produces any difference in society. Because New Zealanders are very practical, very pragmatic. Well, they don't see any real difference between those who go to church and those who don't go to church. They're nice. Well, we got a nation full of nice people who never go to church. You may go, you may not go. You know, we go. It's New Zealand. Whatever you want to do, it's fine. But because people do not see any dynamic difference. They basically take a look around and see everyone's absorbed in material nature, whether they believe or not believe. So, who needs religion? We need to introduce the bhakti process, which is the eternal characteristic of the living entity. The dynamics of the bhakti process nothing can compare to those dynamics in depth, in scope, and in happiness. So this is why we're going through so much effort to present the timeless knowledge of the Vedas with the conclusion. The conclusion is loving devotional service to the Supreme Enjoyer is the ultimate attainment. We're going through so much trouble to introduce persons to that. I think we have a few persons here from the USA, so we'll speak briefly about the USA beyond New York. The Americans here, in case you don't know, who we have, is Izzy here? Yes, and I'm here. Any others? Okay, so you might not realize it, but that from overseas, the USA is seen as a religious country, meaning that a huge percentage of the population goes to church. Now, overseas, they don't take that very seriously. They say it as a joke, especially in New Zealand. Country, you know. They take it as a joke because they don't see any difference in the behavior. Very religious country that has a thing about oil. And if you have oil, you'll find that country in your backyard. that's how they see it here. Anyway, I'm not saying whether it's the perception's right or wrong. I'm just speaking about, So again, we have the same problem. People think, what value does religion really have? Other than your own headspace of what's going on. You have your beliefs, I've got my beliefs. I told you one example. I was doing a program in Sydney, Australia, and there was young guys there, in their 20s, who were already well-connected and making their way through life. And one was, investment banker, another one worked for the various corporations. They were, you would say, young men positioned for rising on the economic ladder. They were cosmopolitan and all that. So I'm just sitting with them and discussing, what does everyone do? So one said, I'm into yoga. Everyone said, oh, great, great. Another one said, I'm into Buddhism. Great, great. Another one said, yeah, I'm into scuba diving. Oh, great, great. I'm into, the gliding? Paragliding? Yeah, great, Buddhism, yoga, paragliding, scuba diving, whatever's in your head. Whatever you believe in, fine, we're open. So, again, the problem is that people don't see any real difference. Of course, it could also be pointed out that they don't want to see a difference, because that's very threatening. I have an uncle, and he's been very successful all his life. He's in his 70s now. He was a corporate engineer, meaning an engineer who had his own engineering outfit, and he managed that. So he retired. He's in his 70s. Oh, he asked. So he sent me a message. I hadn't heard from him in years. Do you have any information about reincarnation? I guess he was starting to wonder. is there a future? but he comes from a Christian background. So anyway, I sent him a file from the book I wrote, Searching for Vedic India, which explains reincarnation very conclusively from all points of view, even discusses how it was a quite common understanding in early Christianity, but then through various institutional processes in the early Catholic Church, it was pushed aside. So I sent it to him, and then I noticed I didn't get any response. So I asked him, when I saw him again, like, what did you think? He said, oh, I don't know if I want to think. It's just too challenging. I don't know if I want to think. He said, I just came to the conclusion I just better drop it. In other words, look, I'm in my 70s, the die's already cast. Just leave it at that, whatever happens will happen. People don't want to think. It reminds me of the statement by the famous American comedian. He said, my mind's already made up. Don't try to confuse me with the facts. People don't want to be shaken out of their groove. And I can appreciate that to a certain extent. It's very uncomfortable having your basic concepts challenged, and Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam certainly do that. They just get underneath and shake everything. And they're like earthquakes. Those of you from Christchurch, you have experienced earthquakes. So that's what Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam do. They just get underneath you and just shake everything. And it can be uncomfortable if you're attached. Now, you have to consider, though, what is it that you're attached to? If you can see the illusion about what you're attached to, if you can see the suffering that your attachments are causing you, then you don't mind the earthquake. Or if you are looking for higher knowledge, then you welcome the earthquake. I want to know more. I'm not knowing enough. I mean, after all, I don't even know who I am, so I should try to get some higher knowledge. So either you realize that your current assumptions, your current conceptions are causing you distress, or you realize your current fund of knowledge is very tiny. From both those two approaches, you won't mind the earthquake underneath you, the earthquake of changing a paradigm. Most persons, as I travel the world, who approach bhakti, they say it's out of material distress. That doesn't mean that they're poor or sick. No, they can be very wealthy, very educated, but they've been through such distressing experiences in life that they're motivated to seek another way of life. Most persons, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, chapter of Vidha, Bhajante Mam, Jana Sukhatino Arjuna, four types of persons approach me, Krishna says, and all are meritorious. Sukriti, all have auspicious merit. Someone who's distressed, someone looking for prosperity. It doesn't really happen in the first world countries that someone will come to bhakti looking for economic prosperity. But in other countries, it's quite common. Someone who's looking for satisfying their curiosity, and someone who wants the greatest knowledge. So all these persons Krishna considers glorious in that they are approaching him. So that is the conclusion of the Vedas, to approach the supreme enjoyer. And that means you understand that you are meant to be enjoyed. Think about that. What a different change in your mind that's about. My life is meant for someone else's pleasure. Sounds intimidating at first, doesn't it? Because everything you've been taught is that your life is meant for you. What is going to fulfill you? So you've got a world full of persons who think like that. And guess what the result is? There's all kinds of turmoil. There's all kinds of shortages. All kinds of conflicts. So in that way, it's obvious, if you can think with purified intelligence, that you can't have everyone running around thinking that they are the enjoyer. Even in relationships, it doesn't work. The dream may be that. Traditionally speaking, you know, the man and woman, they come together and they're all both thinking that their being together will maximize their enjoyer status. So they size each other up. What will you do for my enjoyment? Each person looks at that. And also, I can contribute to your enjoyment. What can you contribute to my enjoyment? So our considering that we are not the enjoyer is a radical change. But how do you actually live in that way? What's the lifestyle for not being the enjoyer? Where do you find that? Just having religious belief won't solve the problem. I believe that there's a creator. Well, that's considered kindergarten stuff from the bhakti point of view. But once you start thinking, I believe that there's a supreme enjoyer, and it's not me, well then, if you're actually going to live your beliefs, you're going to walk your talk, there has to be a big change. How do you live with the knowledge that you are meant to be enjoyed by the supreme enjoyer? So this is why, for the sake of our newcomers, for the sake of our oldcomers also, this is why bhakti looks so different. Because you've just radically changed your standpoint. No longer are you running around the world thinking you're the enjoyer. He makes it, well, you don't think you're the supreme enjoyer. That's humility. I'm not the supreme enjoyer. Oh, I would never say that. I'm an enjoyer. You're an enjoyer. You're an enjoyer. What's the problem? Everyone's an enjoyer. reminds me of one newscast, live newscast. Someone told me about when the American troops, when they were invading Iraq to get rid of Saddam Hussein and get the oil and bring democracy. So they were invading Iraq and, you know, entering into Baghdad, and the whole place was devastated. The troops are roaring in their tanks and armored vehicles, and so the people started to surround them in the tanks and the armored vehicles. And someone told me, you could see right on live, it's all live coverage TV for everything these days. So they could see a bunch of people surrounding the soldiers. And what was the first thing they said? Coca-Cola, Michael Jackson. Bring us the status of being an enjoyer. Free us from a non-consumerist lifestyle. Of course, we understand the atrocities that Saddam Hussein performed, but at the same time, it shows that even in bleak circumstances, people consider that the improvement in life is to be allowed to be the enjoyer. And religion should also do that. That's why Srimad Bhagavatam is so strong in the very beginning. Dharma Pujita Kaitavatra Paramo Namatsaranam Satam. Bhagavatam takes any selfish motivation for performing spiritual life and kicks it out the door. That's in verse number 2 of 18,000 verses. So it just takes the stand immediately. No spiritual life performed for mystic powers, no merging into the impersonal oneness, no pious activities for going to the heavenly planets. All swept out. Any kind of performance of spiritual activities for material gain in any kind of way, subtle or gross, kicked out, projita. And what is presented? What's the positive? Pure love, unadulterated love between the supreme enjoyer and the living entity. That is Bhagavatam. So, let's get back to understanding, again, how it is that bhakti is the culmination of the Vedas. It's beyond just understanding your spirit soul. We talk a lot about that because we have to get people to, at least to first base, get them to the first understanding that you're not material. Once they understand that, then you can explain, well, what is the reality you're embedded in as spirit soul? For example, if you're a New Zealand citizen, you know you're embedded in New Zealand's social system. You get certain kind of health care, you get certain this, you have to pay GST, you have to, you know, pay so many things like that. So what is required as a spirit soul? What do you do? And what do you exist in relation to? So simply understanding your non-material, that's not enough. You've got to understand what you exist in relation to. And that is what bhakti is all about. Not simply duties, obligations, and commitments, but what about spontaneous love? That is the height of bhakti. So again, the spirit soul needs to understand it's in relationship. Again, think of the example. All your life, you've been a bachelor, and then one morning you wake up and you realize, I'm married. And also, then, a couple who are thinking to have children other couples always tell them, you don't know what it's like. Life will never be the same. Selfish. No doubt about it. Life will never be the same. But before the child is born, you don't know. I've had so many couples tell me that. We heard this, but the full impact never is. That our life is not simply our own anymore. Someone else has taken over the house. Someone else has taken over our life. We're in the back seat. I said, well, didn't you discuss that with others? Yeah, they said it, but we just thought. The full impact doesn't hit you. So, similarly, what is the full impact that we exist in relationship to Krishna? That's what bhakti is about. Far beyond understanding simply that you're spirit soul, or that there's an all-pervading spiritual reality, which there is. Far beyond mystic powers, what to speak of, far beyond good karma. To make things short, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, by all the Vedas, I am to be known. Vedanta, Krishna says, he's the conclusion of the Vedas. He's the end of the Vedas. Now, how are we going to deal with all that amidst the illusions and agitations so overwhelming today? That is the question. How are we going to actually experience and taste the supremacy of devotional service? What is the practical method? So that's why when you go to a chemist or pharmacist, you bring the prescription from the doctor, and the chemist or pharmacist fulfills that prescription based on what the doctor has prescribed. So it's not that you prescribe for yourself. And that's a hard thing for many people to accept these days. When, in terms of spiritual life, when you go to a doctor and he gives you a medical prescription, you accept that. Very few persons do a complete investigation of the pharmaceutical business. If you did, you'd be horrified. If you do that, find out what these pharmaceutical companies are up to. Billions upon billions of dollars of profit. How they can also destroy any alternative medical researchers who come up with cures that are very cheap and would threaten the billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar businesses of these pharmaceuticals. I know. He was telling me, he has personally witnessed these things, how persons who come up with dazzling new health cures, which aren't quack things all the time, sometimes they're very, very significant, but they require a little money to certify, and they require some patience, some time, so that the results can be certified. But they're at least shut down by various legal and illegal methods. A doctor was telling me there was one medical researcher who was way outside the box and came up with an astounding approach to curing some particular medical problem. And it was costing pennies. It would cost the patient pennies compared to what they would have to spend through the pharmaceutical industry. And the results would be questionable. So the doctor was telling me that what happened was there were like 25 places in the USA that were working on this particular alternative medical breakthrough. There's like 25 independent doctors who are checking it out. And so what happened at the same time of the day in all these different locations, a squad of men broke in and with baseball bats and smashed all the alternative medical equipment at the same time of the day. And very intimidating, you know. 25 locations at the same time of the day, these guys come breaking into your medical office and just, you know, smashed all the equipment, burned all the papers, destroyed all the research. That was it. And the medical innovator who was responsible for this breakthrough, he just became, he was so depressed. Basically his life was over. He was just finished emotionally. He couldn't understand, I'm on the verge of a great breakthrough that will help humanity. Isn't that what it's all about? Doesn't anyone understand helping humanity? That's the greatest thing. Isn't that what the world's about? No. No. He saw the real face of reality. The world is about profit. And if you're piling in multi-billions of dollars a year, you don't want some small-time little guy upsetting your business and coming up with a cure that will just, no one can make any money off of it. You can't patent it. So these things go on. But the point is that if you are smart, you follow medical prescriptions without taking into account what the pharmaceutical industry is up to in all cases. They do some good, they do some bad, like everything in this world. We're not, you know, bagging anything completely. Everything has some good, some bad. That's the story of material existence. Some good, some bad. You never get the pure thing that your heart is hankering for. It'll always be some good, some bad. And we consider that's the way it is, right? That's life. It doesn't get any better than that. There'll be some good and some bad. It'll always be like that. And that's the kind of advice that pragmatic parents hand down to their children. I remember my father telling me, son, just remember, choose your battles. Don't try to, struggle in every situation. Don't try to be victorious in every situation. Just choose your battles. You can't win them all. He was telling that especially to my middle brother, who for a while was a political activist. So my father kind of, son, I don't know, you can defeat the system. You know, the system's been around for a long time, and you know, it has some good things, has some bad things, you know. You know, choose your battles. I think it was that my middle brother had decided he wasn't going to register for the draft. At that time, there was a draft in the USA. Every young man had to register for being inducted into the Army, whether it happened or not. So my brother decided he wasn't going to do that. So during the Vietnam War, hell no, we won't go. So, so my mom said, well... I don't know if you want to fight this battle. Has very significant effects on your future career. So then, being a man who was wise to how to manipulate the system, my father told him, here's what you do. He was a high official in New York City Police Department, so he knew how bureaucrats work and how the law works. He said, what time is the military registration office close? It closes at 5:00. Go there at 5:05. And just tell them that you're a very complicated case and you would really like your complicated case to be discussed. It's not that you're protesting the Vietnam War, God forbid, no. And it's not that you have anything against the government. It's just that you have other complications by you can't participate in military service. So you go there 5:55 on a Friday. I guess in New Zealand would be what, 5 minutes to three on a Friday? That's the first thing that persons from overseas who are working, who start to work in New Zealand will find out. But the weekend begins at, 3 o'clock on Friday, not 5 o'clock. So anyway, surveys show that Americans they work harder than anyone in the world, especially compared to Europeans. So, my brother went in at 5 minutes to 5. I'm here to register for the Army, but I've got a lot of complications. I really need to talk to a few people about here. I want to do things in the right way, present all my complications in the right way. And the lady was, 3 minutes to 5, it's better. I want to get out of here. My brother said, I'm here, I'm ready to cooperate. Just complications. Aren't you ready to hear my complications? The lady was getting more and more exasperated. 2 minutes to 5. Finally, she just looked at him. Just, look, what do you want? Here. Give me your papers. Boom, standard. Exempt from the 2 military service. My father, he knew a little something how to manipulate the system. Anyway, the best advice parents can usually give their children from the material point of view is just choose your battles, roll with the punches, try to fulfill your dreams, try to be happy in whatever kind of way that you can be happy, and don't try to hurt anyone. That's it. What is the prescription for genuine spiritual advancement? Just like you have a medical prescription, ideally it should be for your well-being, and it should be authentic, it should be well-researched. Not that you're given a prescription for a certain pharmaceutical and then 2 years later it's pulled off the market because which that happens quite often. Things haven't been researched as well as they should have been. So, in any case, what is the spiritual prescription for our particular circumstances in this day and age? That is what Lord Chaitanya is speaking about in this first verse. What's going to work now? Of course, if you understand who Lord Chaitanya is, everything starts to click. But let's just look at Lord Chaitanya as a highly pragmatic, insightful spiritual teacher. He's telling you what's going to actually work for you. Of course, we understand who Lord Chaitanya really is, and that makes us even much more interested to hear what he has to say. How it is that the Supreme Enjoyer comes in the role of the enjoyed, just to teach us how to be enjoyed by Krishna. That's the mystery of Lord Chaitanya. So he's looking around, so to speak, to see what is the prescription that'll work in this day and age. And the conclusion you have in this first verse of Shastaka, Cheta, Tarpana, Marjana. How are you going to purify your consciousness? Consciousness, heart, often considered the same in the yoga texts because the heart is the seat of consciousness. We're not talking about that the consciousness is hidden somewhere in the ventricles or something. Somewhere inside the heart tissue, heart muscles. No. The soul is a non-material reality, as you know, and the consciousness of the soul is expressed in the heart area. There's not a one-to-one connection between consciousness and the heart. But to make a long story short, you can say chitta, the heart, chitta, the consciousness. But how is that consciousness going to be purified? Chitta tarpana marjana. This is the first task, because it is the dirty things in the heart that are causing us our problems. What is the dirt in the heart or in the consciousness. Now, where have you ever been educated about consciousness and the contaminants in consciousness? Where do you get that kind of knowledge? Our guest Izzy was telling me her family's from San Diego, so I always think there's a world famous husband and wife team of professors at the University of San Diego. And they are staunch materialists and proud. There is nothing spiritual. Everything is material. Your consciousness is simply a neurochemical nerve reaction in your brain. Oh, they are so vehement about it. It's like with evangelical fervor, but no proof. Anyway, they're world famous. They are the acharyas. They are the prime teachers of this belief that consciousness is simply a neurochemical synapse or something going on in the brain. That's all it is. If that's the case, then why worry about Chaitanya Tarpa and a margin? Why worry about purifying the dirty things in your consciousness? And that's exactly the point. Redefine the goal of human life. Why worry about cleansing consciousness when it's just some kind of neurochemical, you know, whatever, you know? There's no self. Free will is an illusion. That's their next postulation. That since consciousness is just some biological, neurochemical, something or the other in the brain, and free will is an illusion. If so. Now, if you take all that to its end result, you wonder, well, why should I worry about what I do? What does it matter anyway? Obviously, Lord Chaitanya is speaking from a different viewpoint. Chaitanya Tarpana Marjana. You have to think about your consciousness and how you're going to purify your consciousness. The particles of dust in your consciousness are thinking you're the body and mind. And once you think you're the body and mind, it's natural you're going to think you're the enjoyer. How do you cleanse the mirror of your consciousness? We're going to be speaking more about what do you see in the mirror of pure consciousness. So many of you are familiar with the need to purify your consciousness, cleanse the dust from the mirror. But what do you see once the mirror is clean? You see, bhakti goes all the way from purification to reestablishment in your pure loving relationship with Krishna. And it's that pure loving relationship with Krishna that you see when the mirror is clean. So the first step is get the dust off the mirror. Lord Chaitanya wants you to be concerned with that. The victory begins there. Just like a journey begins with a single step, the bhakti victory begins with getting the mirror off the, getting the dust off the mirror of the heart. Then, param vijayate, Sri Krishna Sankirtan. There can be victory. So, Lord Chaitanya wants you to be concerned with how there is victory. What are you getting? What are you being victorious over? What are you defeating? That's there in this first verse of Shastra. The super excellence of chanting Hare Krishna is because it is not by just a hair's breadth, but by far the only effective means to cleanse the dust from the mirror of the heart so that you can actually see what is your original constitutional nature. We're not negativists. We're not the body. We're not matter. We're not material. That will only get you so far. It's a good beginning. But we have to understand what we are. What is our spiritual nature and how do we act in our spiritual nature? That is the point of the bhakti process. So therefore, when you look at your need for purification, when you look at your need to be established in your original loving relationship with Krishna, the Supreme Enjoyer, therefore, Param Vajayate Sri Krishna Sankirtana. Therefore, all glories to the congregational chanting of Hare Krishna. That's why we were explaining last night. Don't take this chanting and dancing to be material. The word chanting is becoming very popular in the world now. I was speaking at our farm, New Govardhan, in Australia, how I remember when I was working on editing Prabhupada's books, 1975 or 76, and I kept noticing that Srila Prabhupada kept speaking about demigod worship. How does that relate? Because at that time, there were very few Indians in the USA. The massive immigration hadn't begun. So most of our temples had very few persons from India even attending on Sunday, let's speak of fully practicing devotees. So even though we were going to India every year to Mayapur and Vrindavan, the full impact hadn't hit us then. A huge portion of the world's population believes in demigod worship. So I was saying to our head editor, at the time, is Jai Dwaita, now Jai Dwaita Maharaj, of course, and Jai Dwaita Das. So I said, why is Prabhupada always talking so much about demigod worship? I mean, how does that relate to society? I know those coming from India, it sounds funny, you know? I just told you how we can be so small. Like, who thinks about demigod? I don't know anyone in Los Angeles who thinks that. I haven't met anyone in New York. So I remember the head editor, Jai Veda, he told me, Prabhupada knows there'll be coming a time when there'll be many persons who that Krishna devotees have to deal with who are from a background of demigod worship. Writing his books for thousands of years into the future. So he's covering all the things that could appear in the future. It's okay. And he says, wow, that's... you believe in demigod worship? Okay. I guess Prabhupada knows. Because even though we were going to India, we were seeing India through the viewpoint of a Krishna Bhakta. Yeah, we were just going straight to Mayapur, straight to the Krishna Balaram Mandir in Vrindavan. So we thought, well, yeah. So, now you know, of course, that as the world becomes more and more globalistic, and that cultural barriers are reducing, and people are aware of how people think in all parts of the world. Yet, now everyone knows that so many persons from India, they come from a background of demigod worship. And so, Prabhupada was dealing with that misunderstanding. But now what's going on? In the Western world, Westerners are becoming attracted to demigod worship. They're having... In the area around the New Govardhan farm in Australia, there are various kirtans going on. And they're chanting the names of the demigods. They're not chanting Krishna's names. It's considered cool. One devotee was telling me, because he records these demigod kirtans done by Westerners. And they all come together and, well, who are you into? I'm into Durga. What about you? I'm into Shiva. No, I meant to Ganesh, and they wear t-shirts with a picture of the demigod on it. It's like a fashion. So I'm just seeing. Things change very quickly. So something that we thought was not applicable suddenly becomes universally applicable. There's not too many combinations that you can come up with in material existence. Basically, it's a rerun movie. There's only a certain amount of options. So, in the Western world, demigod worship is now becoming popular. And so, you may go to a Western kirtan gathering, and if you try to chant Hare Krishna, they'll tell you, no, why are you just chanting Hare Krishna? What about Durga? What about Ganesh? At a Western gathering, you're talking. It's very interesting. Our prescription means total cleansing of the consciousness so that we can actually see what our real business in life is. And that real business in life is the pure, unadulterated love between the individual spirit soul and the supreme spirit soul. That is what bhakti is about. And the victory is in understanding how chanting Hare Krishna is the preeminent devotional activity in all phases of spiritual life. When I say chanting of Hare Krishna, I particularly mean together. Sankirtan means togetherness, glorification of Krishna. That togetherness in sound glorification of Krishna is the preeminent spiritual activity, whether you're a neophyte or you're on the platform of prema bhakti. So it's not that you're chanting now to attain a state where you won't chant. At all phases of your spiritual development, the chanting of Hare Krishna, Sankirtan, congregational chanting of Hare Krishna, is the preeminent spiritual expression which drives all the other processes of devotional service. That is the story, particularly in the age of Kali. Jiva Goswami explains that. Without chanting Hare Krishna, without Sankirtan, the congregational chanting of Hare Krishna, the other processes of devotional service don't really get going. So we're always going to be doing this congregational kirtan. So much so that Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur points out, you realize your original spiritual identity, your swarup, your identity in Krishna's pastimes, that's realized within the kirtan, within the congregational chanting. And after you realize your original identity in relation to Krishna, in the kirtan, amidst the kirtan, then if it's wanted, in terms of your devotional service, you can go off alone and, like Haridas Thakur, just chant Hare Krishna in seclusion. But first you realize the swarup within the kirtan. See how important the kirtan is? At all phases, it's important for the newcomers, you know. They can express themselves, you know. I was watching last night. That's good. Yes. You can freestyle, you can... Don't feel obligated that you have to, you know, move in step with everyone else. You can dance to a different drummer, so to speak. Don't feel that your individuality is curtailed and that you look around and see everyone's moving in a certain direction or marching this way and that way. You have to do it too. You don't. You can individually express yourself. I was watching, I guess, Izzy. She was freestyling. She had a spot by the door there. Right? You know, it's better than a nightclub. So, things begin in that way. The joy of chanting Hare Krishna together. I remember when I first discovered it, because as you know, I never went to any gathering, Krishna conscious gathering. For 6 months after I started reading Srila Prabhupada's books for 4 hours a day. So I read for 4 hours a day for 6 months before I'd even think of attending a gathering like this or even a small little workshop or whatever. 4 hours a day, 6 months. I was skeptical. New Yorkers are cynical and skeptical. But once I went, finally, in December of 72, and they told me that they have chanting and dancing parties on the street. Well, that sounds really cool. Dancing in the street. In other words, I don't have to spend money to go to a club. So I remember great happiness. Yeah, I was still wearing regular attire, and they told me the chanting party is going to be on at this street corner in Manhattan. It was like Times Square, you know, like millions of tourists, millions of people going by. Wow, this is great. I can just join a public dancing group. So with great happiness, I joined the Harinam party. Yeah. Just thinking, well, this, my motivations were just dance to music, in a group, in public. Wow, how great. Everyone is happy. Everyone in this group looks happy. It seems to me like something I read about in those books. So, a newcomer will see it in that way. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the kirtan is the life and soul of all types of devotees. And indeed, as Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur says, you will, in the pure mirror of your heart, you'll see your original relationship with Krishna amidst the kirtan party first. Then you can think about going off on your own and perhaps trying to imitate Haridas Thakur. So don't think that this congregational chanting is something just, it's just some kind of ritual or some kind of release of energies or something like that. No, it is the most scientific process. At all levels of spiritual attainment. And it's what makes the other devotional processes fully energized. That's another reason why Lord Chaitanya says, Param Vijayate, Sri Krishna Sankirtan. Complete victory. Param Vijayate. Complete victory, not partial victory. Complete victory and total defeat of the unwanted things in the heart. Total defeat. To the point that you will be able to see in the purified mirror of your heart, your original relationship with Krishna. Complete victory from A to Z. Complete victory. So we'll be discussing more tomorrow. This verse from Shikshastra. We'll be discussing tomorrow the different types of pure ego. Krishna is a pure ego. We have a pure ego which we've forgotten. We'll also be discussing Bhava Mahadavadi, the blazing fire of material existence, which in our moments of delusion, or hours of delusion, or days of delusion, we think feels good. Those flames feel good. How nice it is to be roasted. How to extinguish that blazing forest fire. That's Lord Caitanya's concern. This is what he wants to do. And what is the good fortune that will come upon us? What is the positive benediction of chanting Hare Krishna? You see, so many persons on various spiritual paths can become concerned with the illusion of material existence. But what is it that you do when you're out of illusion? That's the mystery. Because of lack of understanding, variegatedness in the pure spiritual reality, persons will have no other choice but voidism or impersonalism. Well, after you get out of material illusion, you just disappear. Thank goodness, that's better than living a life of suffering. Or after you come out of the blazing forest fire of material existence, you realize that, well, since there's no spiritual variegatedness, there's no spiritual individuality, it must be that you become the spiritual reality. Yes, that must be it. You become the all-pervading it. Unless we understand the variety, the variegatedness, how individuality is possible in the ultimate spiritual reality, will be attracted to those other so-called solutions. So bhakti means you've got to learn how to deal with yourself as an eternal individual. That's scary for a lot of people. Just think, materially, consciously or unconsciously, many people are just looking for relief and release. They actually unconsciously want to commit suicide. So if there's a spiritual solution that allows you just to end your problematic individuality by merging, so-called merging, into the Supreme, you go for it. Oh, yeah. If you can't beat Krishna, you join him. You become him. No, how about you serve him? Serve? Subordination? Forget it. I've been serving and becoming subordinate all my life. I'm tired of working for someone. I'm tired of submitting to someone else's desires. That's my family, husband or wife, the boss at work, professors at the university. Submit. And now you're trying to offer me the bhakti process, which means to admit your subordination to the supreme enjoyer? No way. Give me some other option. So, you want some other option? Okay, they're out there. Perform yoga to realize that you are the peace. Perform meditation so that you can see you are it and it is you. Yes, there are many options out there which will try to sway you in that way. They don't say it up front at first. Some do, but others just, you just yoga and meditation and you'll feel less stress and you become a vegetarian, which is nice. And then finally start asking, where does all this lead? Where does this lead? It leads to the realization that we are just all the one, and the one is all us. Ooh, that sounds mystical. Remember last time you were watching the video of Prabhupada's beginnings in Lower Manhattan, and dealing with the young people at the time, and for them everything was mystical. So people become impressed still by that notion today. We are the one, and the one is us. There's no individuality. There's no difference between me or you or anyone or anything. Because no one can live like that. So swamis fly over from India and make a good living saying like that. course, now the Western mystics have realized, hey, we got to get in on this business. So there's, you know, it's not only Indian swamis are flying over and presenting impersonalism as the goal. The Westerners are into it. They don't take on Sanskrit names. That's part of their presentation, their marketing. You know, I'm Bill Jones. I'm a mystic. And without your being caught up in all that cultural stuff from India, Sanskrit and Krishna, this or that, I'm going to just teach you. I'm going to just get right to the bottom line. You are it, and it is you. Sign up for my workshop, $200 per weekend, and you'll find out all about it. So it's the same old thing going on all the time in material existence. There are only so many options you have. Karma kanda, balancing the good and bad karma. Then kana kanda, understanding your spiritual identity in terms of not being material and the all-pervading spiritual energy. And then path of mystic yoga, increasing your mystic powers to a point beyond what anyone can realize today. And then there's bhakti. And there's also demigod worship. Broadly speaking, there's upasana kanda, devotion, which at its minimal level means demigod worship. It includes demigod worship. And then in its full understanding, it means Krishna bhakti. Even demigod worship means you have to acknowledge there's a personality you have to deal with. So tomorrow we'll be speaking about what is the prime good fortune, the positive benediction that chanting Hare Krishna brings. So for today, please understand, when you are joining in this congregational chanting, you are at the conclusion of the Vedas. You are practicing the pinnacle of mystic yoga, the pinnacle of philosophical metaphysical wisdom. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.